Mister. En la Hiroshima. On WZBC Newton 90.3 FM, listening there to Kraftwerk, the German industrial band, I guess you might call them, from beginning in the 1970s, their song Radioactivity, which became a kind of an anthem of the anti-nuclear movement, mentioning by name Sellafield, British nuclear plant, and many others across Europe and the United States and Three Mile Island. Kraftwerk. It means power station in German. You're tuned to WZBC Newton 90.3 FM. Well, President Obama, in discussing the nuclear agreement with Iran to monitor its nuclear power production and head off and prevent Iran from developing a nuclear weapon, President Obama said, without a deal, we risk even more war in the Middle East, and other countries in the region would feel compelled to pursue their own nuclear programs, threatening a nuclear arms race in the most volatile region in the world. Interesting, because there already are nuclear weapons in the Middle East. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said, today a terrorist nuclear superpower is born, and it will go down as one of the darkest days in world history. Ironic, because Iran does not have nuclear weapons, but the Prime Minister of that country, Israel, does have them. Here with us to take a look at this is Grant F. Smith. He directs the Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy. He's the author of two unofficial histories about the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, perhaps the largest foreign government lobbying organization in the United States. Grant Smith's books include America's Defense Line and Foreign Agents, AIPAC from the 1963 Fulbright hearings to the 2005 espionage scandal. Grant Smith, thank you for joining us today and welcome.
Thanks for having me on, John.
Yeah, it's our pleasure. Grant Smith, I'm just curious what your reaction was to this description of the Middle East as a potential nuclear arms race location. Has that race already begun?
Well, it's a very dishonest characterization when you have both the Israeli government and the U.S. government continually, since the 1970s, refusing to formally recognize or even discuss what everybody pretty much already knows, which is that the Israelis have had a nuclear arsenal, a deployed nuclear arsenal, for decades and decades. So, you know, when Obama says that there could be a nuclear arms race, that's not a useful characterization. The race has already started, and as noted this week, I would characterize it as a race in which Israel has been lapping the field over the past decades.
Israel's nuclear weapons arsenal is still not officially acknowledged in the way that other countries acknowledge or are pushed or even forced to acknowledge that they have these weapons. How did it come about, although virtually every specialist in the world of every political stripe believes and even documents that Israel has nuclear weapons. And in fact, Mordecai Vanunu, an Israeli nuclear technician, went to jail for many years because he revealed that he worked in a nuclear plant and the existence of the nuclear weapons. How did it come about that Israel still hasn't officially acknowledged it has what some people estimate to be well over 60, perhaps a couple of hundred nuclear warheads?
Well, again, it's the fault of our own government, John. The Israeli program was something the Kennedy administration became aware of relatively quickly back in the 60s and pressured secretly Levi Eshkol and other Israeli leaders not to pursue nuclear weapons. And so, you know, when he left office and when LBJ came in, there was a real ratcheting down of the non-proliferation drive as it applied to Israel. And what has been released recently by the National Archives in documents of the Nixon administration, both Kissinger and Nixon basically acquiesced to Golda Meir's demand that there be a gag policy about the nuclear arsenal. Henry Kissinger has famously said that acknowledgement would be the, you know, tantamount to creating a huge problem greater than just simply ignoring and never formally recognizing the arsenal. So the U.S. has been complicit in this sort of charade in which we agree not to pressure the Israelis. The Israelis have a formula of saying, we're never going to be the first to introduce nuclear weapons into the region. And reporters are horrible on this issue. Only a few ever try and buttonhole prime ministers or presidents to get them to admit what polls say 64% of Americans already believe, which is that Israel has nuclear weapons. So we have this false debate, and it really serves some interest groups, which I hope we discuss, while really making this issue of Iran overblown. And so I think we should, it's something that has created a false narrative that doesn't allow people to see what's really going on.
What was it that occurred when Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu more or less threatened to bomb Iran, was perceived as a nuclear threat?
Well, the Israelis have by having an undeclared arsenal, they have a real coercive power, not just in hinting that they might take action, but imagine if there were an honest debate in the press, Americans would say, okay, Israel has nuclear weapons, so is what's happening is that the United States is being pressured by this nuclear state to attack Iran with conventional weapons, to prohibit Israel from attacking it with nuclear weapons? Is that what's going on? That would be a very, very good, clean debate. But when you don't acknowledge Israel's nuclear weapons or its history of development, which involves a lot of interaction with the U.S., if you don't admit that Israel could actually destroy Iran with a nuclear attack, then you don't understand really what's been going on with the sanctions, really what's been going on with pressure on the U.S. But there's a tremendous coercive power that Netanyahu has over the U.S. as much as he does over regional politics, by the existence of that arsenal.
My understanding is that in April, or early April, late March of this year, in 2015, Israel's intelligence minister said Israel will consider military action against Iran if it felt that Iran's nuclear program threatened them. Yuval Steinitz said, if we have no choice, we have no choice. The military option is on the table. There have been other statements by Israeli officials over the years that if they that are perceived as threats when they come out of the mouth of any world leaders from any country, and so I have to wonder, when Israel and its leaders make these bellicose threats, including about with nuclear weapons in play and a nuclear confrontation at stake, how does the rest of the world see that outside the United States, which is heavily lobbied by AIPAC?
Well, I think the rest of the world, and I haven't conducted polls, and I haven't seen polls about, perceptions of Israel's nuclear weapons, but the rest of the world, and in Europe in particular, considers Israel to be a very destabilizing influence when it makes those types of threats. And although there's been a real mistranslation circulated about Iran supposedly wanting to wipe Israel off the map, the real translation was that it thought the regime would disappear over time. There's this perception that the Israelis can actually deliver on threats. They can make more subtle threats, but they carry a lot more weight, and they particularly carry a lot more weight at the UN because everyone knows the score in the UN. They all know that Israel is a nuclear state, despite its non-admission and despite U.S. collusion in this non-recognition. And so they know that if they don't act, Israel can deliver upon its threats. I would, however, say that Iran does not, and it doesn't appear to have a serious nuclear weapons program. Their leadership doesn't appear to think that nuclear weapons are something that they want. And so, in judging by the reaction of the groups opposed to this sort of extension of the non-proliferation treaty that Iran is going to have to comply with, it really looks as though the nuclear issue has been a convenient vehicle for challenging Iran and its support for Hezbollah, its support for Syria, with an issue that Americans will buy, just like the issue of weapons of mass destruction were a threat that they bought before the invasion of Iraq. And so by solving this problem and seeing the sanctions go away, this sort of financial confrontation that's been going on with Iran is also going to wither away. And that's what's really making opponents of the deal angry, is the fact that there's no longer going to be this overbearing economic warfare against Iran, which does challenge Israel in the region.
Other countries also care about a treaty that was put into effect by a lot of major powers in the world to try to reduce the spread, or what's known as the proliferation, the spread of nuclear technology, nuclear power technology, which brings any country a long way toward the ability to have nuclear weapons, although that is a separate step. Tell me about the gag orders that have existed in the United States against disclosing that Israel officially has a nuclear weapons program.
Sure. Well, basically, we've already talked about this general agreement that occurred between the two governments back in the 70s, the idea that there'd be no official confirmation. But these are also, they are backed by Department of Energy Classification Bulletin WPN 136 on foreign nuclear capabilities, which forbids any federal government employee or contractor to confirm that Israel has a nuclear weapons program. So they're not allowed to confirm what everybody else knows. And recently, an employee at Los Alamos National Laboratory, James Doyle, after he wrote a fairly benign reference to Israel's nuclear weapons, was fired, his pay was cut, his computer was searched, he was fired, all of these consequences. So that bulletin is something that functions as a gag order, and we're fighting with the State Department and with the Department of Energy right now to get it publicly released so that people can see the mechanics of denying information that's critical to the debate. So we're hoping to get that. The State Department's reviewing it right now. The other one is GEN 16, GEN-16. Anybody can read that online. It's basically the government's no-comment policy for whenever anyone raises information that they think's classified. like the fact that Israel has nuclear weapons, that there's a no-comment policy and that government officials will seek to avoid the question and not respond to it and give it any credence, even though it's already out in the public domain. And you can see these in operation. There are videos of officials being confronted. I think Sam Husseini has the best one on YouTube, just being asked, does Israel have nuclear weapons? And they all dodge and get uncomfortable and run away from the mic. And even President Obama did the same when he was confronted by Helen Thomas with that question. So there are gag orders, and it's right now it's secret law. We can't get the most specific one out for public review.
So is this what we call an open secret?
I would say it's an open secret. I would also call it a useless secret because, again, even the policy of not commenting on classified information in the public domain has a subsection that says if this is just completely useless, the government really ought to consider declassifying whatever it thinks it is secret so that we don't have to maintain a charade. That hasn't happened yet here in this case, though. And it's a real disservice to Americans who are basically, under a policy of being treated by the unified front parenting strategy. If you have unruly kids, both parents, agree not to debate anything and just deliver hand-down messages and present a unified front. That's essentially been going on now for decades. So the American, who wants to be in the public policy debate is treated like a child, essentially.
You were instrumental in getting a hold of an FBI report in 2012 that essentially described an investigation about nuclear weapons triggers and other technology being illegally smuggled from the United States and into Israel. Tell us about that.
Sure. The FOIA request that we filed with the FBI was really trying to understand what happened to a company called Milco in Huntington Beach, California, which had illegally shipped 800 nuclear triggers and a bunch of export-prohibited items through a network of front companies connected with the Israeli Ministry of Defense. And we were surprised when we received the documents to see that in a 2002 FBI interview of the president of the company, who was prosecuted and is a felon and went to prison, to see him naming Benjamin Netanyahu as working at one of the front companies and being someone with whom he met in Israel during the smuggling operations. And so it was a very surprising story. 3 years ago, just happened to fall on July 4. We released a report about it and the documents. And although it was widely reported in some parts of the Israeli news, it's a story that it's one of these stories that's never really captivated any establishment journalism attention in the United States. And we've seen that pattern repeated with other major releases of information that have to do with Israel's nuclear weapons and diversions from the United States. But anyone can see those documents online if you simply Google Netanyahu and Crytron with a K. You can examine the documents yourself and see this FBI report.
Partly interesting because you and your organization made the FOIA request, and essentially you broke this story with an article you wrote at antiwar.com. It was subsequently right. Picked up and reprinted in the Israeli press, Arutz Sheva, also in Ma'ariv, a major Israeli newspaper, and others around the world after that.
Right, but not in the U.S.
I don't even remember hearing about it.
No, you didn't hear about it, and there's a real fear and a real sort of disservice that establishment journalists bestow upon us in not you know, not putting this sort of story into the mix. It's a very interesting story. You could certainly sell newspapers and certainly have interesting discussions about it, but it doesn't really fit the narrative. And the narrative here is not talking about Israel's nuclear capability and really focusing on Iran. And so, you know, it didn't fit the narrative, and we continually tweet it to various so-called investigative journalists who just won't touch it. They won't touch it. And unfortunately, the FBI is not releasing any more information about it. Maybe there isn't any more information, but it's a story that deserved, I would say, more of a hearing in the American press where it matters. In this particular instance, you know, it really helps out with this ambiguity and this sort of gag policy when the press doesn't throw it in and start asking, hey, you know, is Netanyahu a very credible non-proliferation guru?
Well, you, listeners can see the documents and read about it at this organization's website, irmep.org. The FBI release from that FOIA request in 2012, June 27th, about Heli Trading Company, H-E-L-I, Heli Trading Limited, Arms Smuggling 1985 is the subject. Grant Smith, just perhaps a time for a final question before we wrap up. And I wonder what you see. Are there any opportunities in the current world attention around the focus on Israel's objection to the United States reaching a deal with Iran to continue a nuclear power program, which it has every right to under the Non-Proliferation Treaty? Iran and other Arab countries are members of, signatories to, the Non-Proliferation Treaty to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons. Do you see any chance that Israel might be pressured to join the nuclear non-proliferation nations?
I don't see that happening anytime soon. I do think, though, taking your point, that there's a great deal of value in this focus on the real reasons for this deal, and its effect in really flushing out groups with a false frame for putting together these sanctions. They're going to be arguing that the U.S. needs to continue them, and they're very disappointed that the international coalition has fallen apart or will be falling apart. So as they come together in rallies and pressure on Congress, there's going to be a real, I think, opportunity for the Obama administration to release information about Israel's nuclear weapons program. And they've already done that in one lawsuit that we won in February of this year, in which we obtained some DOD reports about their nuclear weapons infrastructure. And so I think the fact that the fight is going to continue is going to create a lot of pressures on the Obama administration, which originally had very good policies on wanting there to be a nuclear-free Middle East, and even pressured Israel to initially go to some conferences on establishing that. Recently, they backed away from it. They've been more of an obstacle. But I think it's good in that the pressure is going to create a lot more possibility for reporting on this issue, and the desire for there to be no surprises, no daylight, no public altercations on these sorts of issues, which is what the Israelis and AIPAC and their other groups in this country want, that's probably not going to work. This is just too big a deal.
Well, Grant Smith, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, John.
Grant F. Smith is the director of the Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy. He's author of two unofficial histories about the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. Those are America's Defense Line, the Justice Department's battle to register the Israel lobby as agents of a foreign government, and also the book Foreign Agents, AIPAC, from the 1963 Fulbright hearings to the 2005 espionage scandal. You can find the website of Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy at irmep.org. For Sounds of Dissent, I'm John Grebe.